The following lecture was delivered at the Ginkgo Courtauld Institute of Art Conference, hosted at the Barenboim Said Academy, Berlin, in November 2016.
I'm going to try to join together the cupola and poetry and this wonderful place, and I'll do my best anyway. But first of all, it's a real pleasure to be here. It's such an amazing building, and I adore Berlin, so I'm really happy that Barbara invited me back here. This afternoon, many of you will have spent time at the Museum for Islamische Kunst collection down the road. So you may have seen the one piece there that I want to talk to you about today. I hope you saw it and stood underneath it and went, wow, the effect that it has on most people. The Alhambra Cupola is a carved and painted ceiling that was made for the 14th century palace of the Alhambra in Granada, one of the world's most visited medieval palaces. I was there 2 weeks ago, and I was told 600 people go through the turnstile every hour, every day, except Christmas. So it's very popular still. It was built, of course, as you know, by a succession of Muslim rulers of the Nasrid dynasty during their reign from 1238 to 1492. This cupola, made of hundreds of pieces of exquisitely carved and painted wood, is the only large architectural piece of the palace that's now outside of Granada. It was described in 1978 by the Islamic art historian Richard Ettinghausen as a beautiful and rare ceiling of supreme importance. But even if you haven't visited the Alhambra, you will, I think, have an idea of the palace in your mind. It's a place that has captivated us even for many generations. This shared image that we have of the Alhambra, whether from experience of visiting it or through the literature, music, and art that came out of it, was to a great extent conjured up by the poets, musicians, and artists who lived in the palace in the past 200 years and lived and wrote about the palace for the past 200 years. It was this romantic idea of the Alhambra that inspired Arthur von Gwinner to first visit the palace in 1882. He fell for the poetic charms of the place, and he liked it so much he bought a piece of it, and he brought the cupola here to Berlin. How and why he did this is the subject of my talk today. But it's not only poetry about the Alhambra, written by visitors to the building, that created this pictorial vision that we have of the palace. A vision of the palace as a place of beauty, of pleasure and retreat was written into its walls by the craftsmen of the Nasrid dynasty who built it. The palace building's walls were inscribed with verses composed especially for the spaces and the rooms that they describe by court poets who were close advisors to the Nasrid rulers that they served, the most important of whom were Ibn al-Jayyab, Ibn Zamrah, and Ibn al-Khatib. The many buildings and spaces that make up the Alhambra complex have inscribed in their walls not only Quranic verse, which you find everywhere all over the building, but poetry written in a cursive Arabic script in stucco, carved wood, and cut glazed tiles. And the example that I show you here in an old photograph is shows around the window, I don't know if I have a pointer, around this window you can see the stucco writing, it's carved out of stucco around the side of the window. Nasrid textiles that do survive also show this preoccupation with poetry woven into their very fabric. Poetry, then, was part of the conception of these palaces. Like the marble and brick of its structure, the poems written into the architecture were there at the beginning. Oleg Grabar described them as iconographic inscriptions, explaining that the poems were chosen to emphasize a purpose or association that wasn't, of course, otherwise obvious in the building. The poems on the walls of the Alhambra also allow the reader to understand the building on a metaphorical level. For example, in this verse by Ibn Zamrak that's written onto one of the main palaces, the Court of the Myrtles, this is clearly the most joyful paradise which no one who lives here ever leaves. The shapes of my body resemble the flowers in my garden, and my white face is an image of the morning. The poet likens the palace to the garden of paradise and compares the floral and vegetal motifs that are carved into its very structure to the body and to the garden, and the pale colors of the marble floors of the palaces to a beautiful morning. Another verse inscribed around the window of one of the miradors in the building describes the window itself as the eye and the pupil of the eye as the sultan. I quote, "In this garden, I am an eye filled with delight, and the pupil of this eye is truly our Lord Muhammad V." The poetry then can also help us to see the building as it was in the 14th century, to understand what was noticed by the makers, patrons, and poets of the time. It's not that we use the text to explain the architecture, but as Olga Bush has pointed out, poetry and architecture in this building are inextricably linked and must be experienced together. The reader of one is prepared to become the reader of the other. In the Tower of the Calahorra, a small palatial tower that you usually can't get access to if you're visiting the palace, it's also known as the Tower of the Captive Princess. I think it was named that in the 19th century. Four casidas composed by Ibn al-Jayyab fill the corners of the room, framing cartouches which contain Quranic inscriptions. In the verses, the poet describes the craftsmanship of the floors, the walls, and the ceilings, emphasizing the harmony of their individual elements and helping us, the reader of the poem, to read the room as a single, coherent, and majestic space in which poetry and architecture, stucco, tiles, carpentry, as well as the smells, sounds, and light in the room are as one, they're of equal importance. In particular, the lines that I've highlighted there, I think are very striking. Marvels of stucco and tiles it holds, but the carpentry of its ceiling is even more marvelous. In storing so much treasure, it triumphed in going up and in rising to the highest heights. So as well as praising the ruler and the craftsmanship of the building, the verses tell us something about the function of the spaces. On the walls, the palatial tower is described as a happy meeting place and a pleasurable place of solace. Arthur von Gwinner would have been aware of this way of reading and seeing the palace through poetry. He had read Friedrich von Schack's Poesie und Kunst der Araber in Spanien, in which many of the Arabic poems that had been transcribed by al-Makari in the 16th century were translated into German. It was through these poetic and later romantic descriptions of the Alhambra that Gwinner would first have come across this place, the Partal Palace, and its marvel of carpentry, the cupola contained in its Mirador Tower. You can see on the left where those three windows are on the tower, that is the room in which the cupola was originally made for. The cupola came from the tower in the palace. It was the decorative ceiling that crowned the main room at the top of the tower. This was a place, it wasn't, as some people in the Warburg have suggested, a lover's retreat. It wasn't a soldier's room, it wasn't a military place. This was a place for the sovereign, in which the sovereign could retreat and hold meetings. It was a place from which all views could be controlled by the ruler. Not a place from where the sovereign would survey his lands and in which he could also be seen. It positions the viewer from below and frames the view from inside. A 14th century inscription in the walls of a contemporary mirador reads, "In me, the ruler looks from his caliphal throne towards the capital of his entire kingdom. From this building, you could sit and look down at the whole of Granada, you still can." The cupola crowns a small square room reached by a narrow staircase and originally decorated with carved stucco and tiles up to ceiling level. The court poet Ibn al-Jayyab wrote verses for the room that are carved into the walls in plaster. And these are some of the earliest examples of poetry in the Alhambra that were carved into this room. I quote, "Salutations, noble dwelling, for the fortune and joy experienced, for the glory and hope extended." The cupola was part of this exquisite and carefully thought out room, perfectly placed in its topography with views across the palace, the garden, the city and the hills that were exactly calculated. I will show you some more detailed images of the cupola. This is a very close up. The whole cupola is based on 16 panels, trapezoidal panels around a central star, 16 pointed star. And each panel contains within it these strap work, and they're called zafates, pieces of carved wood, and these were also painted. I can show you some details of that. The inscription inside this star reads, "Wa la ghaliba li Allah," there's no victor but God, and every star contains that. Some of the other views of the cupola close up, but you can see, I hope, some of the red background. This cupola would have been brightly painted and possibly even gilded. And its position, if you remember, its position within the palace, that pool comes right up to the edge of the palace itself. And that pool reflects water directly into the Mirador room itself. so it would have glistened and glittered almost as a crown, a metaphorical crown on the Sultan's head when he was there. So you can see this is some more inscriptions on the walls, and again another close-up just to give you some example of the detail, but as you've all hopefully seen it, I won't need to go into too much of that. It was from this palace that Arthur von Gwinner took the cupola when he bought the Partal Palace in 1885. Gwinner belonged to a generation of late 19th century German intellectual idealists who travelled widely and gave generously. The village of Krumke, where he had his country house outside of Berlin in the Altmark region, people there still remember when they were young, when they were children, he invited them into his home to celebrate Christmas around his tree. So they have fond memories of him. He also paved the streets of Krumke. A member of the management board of the Deutsche Bank from 1894 until 1919, and its spokesman from 1910, he rose to a position of great influence in Berlin between the 1890s and his death in 1931. But it wasn't this influential Gwinner who bought the cupola. In fact, he acquired it as a young man in his late 20s, before he joined the bank, when it seems that many of his formative interests in building railways, in the natural world, and in Islamic Spain were kindled. In the late 1870s, Gwinner moved from his hometown of Frankfurt to London, where he worked for the merchant bank Schuster Sons & Co. And it was probably here, in fact, that he first encountered the Alhambra. London had been gripped by a kind of Alhambra fever ever since Owen Jones published his detailed study of the building in 1842 and built this, his Alhambra Court, to great acclaim in the second iteration of the Crystal Palace exhibition, the Great Exhibition, in 1854. It's a replica of the Lion's Court in the Alhambra. You can see the lions inside and you could walk around this. 6 million people visited these courts over its lifetime. Gwinner's boss at the bank was Leopold Schuster, and he was a German-born Jewish banker who was part of the consortium that bought the Crystal Palace in 1854 and relocated it from Hyde Park to Sydenham. Now, he had an ulterior motive. He was building the railway that brought you from central London down to Sydenham, where he was relocating this Crystal Palace. So he wanted to attract people down there. For part of his time in London, Gwinner lived directly on the edge of the park where this Alhambra Court was situated. In his memoirs, he describes swimming in the landscape lakes of the park early in the morning. So it's likely he spent a lot of time here and got to know the Alhambra through this 19th century version of it. Owen Jones had died before Gwinner arrived in London, but he was friends with one of the assistant keepers of the South Kensington Museum, the previous name of the Victoria and Albert Museum, Johann Wilhelm Appel, who led him to the heart of cultural events in London. He went to the theatre and to art and to opera even, where he describes he really wanted to, through this, to learn about the soul of the English people. You wonder where you'd find it now. Gwinner moved to Madrid by 1880 and spent the next 6 years working for a French bank and acting as consul to the German Empire in Spain. He visited Granada in 1882. Like many of his generation, he'd fallen for this romantic image of the Alhambra. He'd read Schack's book, Poesie und Kunst der Araber, and Washington Irving's Tales from the Alhambra, in which the Alhambra is imagined as this ruined, lost Orient close to home. And what he found there would not have disappointed, as the buildings of the Alhambra, and especially of the Partal Palace that you can see was sketched here, were fast falling into disrepair. There were few restrictions on the movement or activities of visitors in the building complex. And as the collections of many European museums attest, many a tourist helped themselves to their own souvenirs of the Alhambra. Through a friend, the young architect Anton Widmann, who had been drawing the palaces, Gwinner heard that the Partal Palace was for sale. Here's another sketch of it by John Lewis. It had been part of Real Patrimonio until 1828, so it was part of the official Nasrid palaces that were owned by the Spanish royal court. But the lease was sold into private hands in 1828 when the royal family found themselves in deep financial trouble and needed to get rid of some of their Alhambra buildings. The Spanish royal family sold off this Partal building, and it was then adapted. It was in private hands, was adapted in 1837 into a two-story inn or a private house where people would come and stay, people such as these artists, John Lewis and Richard Ford. At the time, many other families also lived in the Alhambra. I think we have to, now we see it as a tourist place where you can visit and you have a ticket and you walk around and then you leave and you go to where people live in Granada. But at the time, certainly in the 1890s, 12 families lived just in the area you can see in this sketch here. People lived in the town of the Alhambra up high in the palace itself. This building became known as Casa Sanchez, after the person who owned it, Mr. Sanchez, in which many visitors to the city stayed for periods of time, while, especially the artists, while they painted and wrote about the city. Gwinner bought it in 1885 from a retired opera singer who remained as his tenant in the place. In fact, Gwinner had already made a painting of the palace with its tower, which was known then as the Torre de las Damas, on his first visit to Granada in 1882. There is a photo you can see here and then an extract from it there, which shows his home it's a photo from about 1928, in which you can see the cupola in the foreground here where he has it in his home and the Nasrid tiles and stucco. But in the background, you can see a painting. Through the two doors, you can see the painting. And the painting, Gwinner himself has written on the side of this photograph, this painting in Spanish, this painting I made in 1882, not knowing that 3 years later, the Torre de las Damas would be mine. So this is the painting he's referring to in the background, which we don't know where it is now, unfortunately. His granddaughter, Frau Maretti Schoenbeck, with whom I've been in touch, she's one of the last remaining people who remember Gwinner when he was alive, and she told me that she vividly recalls him showing her his extraordinary fossil collection underneath the cupola that you see here. It's not difficult to understand why Gwinner bought this rather dilapidated but charming palace in 1885. Its value and provenance as a bona fide royal Nasrid palace were well known. Friedrich Schack himself had described its decoration as some of the best in the Alhambra, while the conservator Rafael Contreras, the then conservator of the Alhambra, had previously in the 1870s lamented the sale of the building by the royal patrimony, the royal household, for its beauty and extraordinary wooden ceiling. He had said it shouldn't have been sold. But what Gwinner, when he bought it, what he intended to do with the palace is less clear. He had married into the wealthy Speyer family of Frankfurt bankers and moved to Berlin in 1886, where he quickly became integrated into the intellectual and financial and cultural scene here. Though he visited Granada on his honeymoon in 1886, I think he was renovating the house, actually, and he brought his new wife to his half-renovated Alhambra house. I wonder how impressed she was. His new career at the Deutsche Bank, though, meant he had little time to devote to this Nasrid Tower. He might have just fallen for its romantic charms. He writes in his memoirs, "Mir schwebte ein zauberisch schöner Landsitz vor." I dreamt of a magically beautiful country house. Or maybe he wanted to restore the buildings, as he says. In his memoirs, he explains he wanted to return it to how it was. Or maybe he saw it as an opportunity to acquire a real version, like something of Owen Jones's replica Alhambra Court that he'd seen in London. The original sale document of the Partal Palace from 1885 contains a clause in which Gwinner states that he specifically wanted to take the techo árabe, or Arab ceiling, and replace it with a newer one. The idea of recreating an Alhambra in one's own home would not have been unfamiliar to Gwinner, though, in the late 19th century. He'd married a Jewish woman and was no doubt familiar with the Neue Synagogue down the road from here in Oranienburger Straße, built by Edward Knoblauch that had opened in 1867, with a newspaper describing it as a fairy tale structure. In the middle of a plain part of the city, we are led into the fantastic wonder of the Alhambra, with graceful columns, sweeping arches, richly colored arabesques, abundant wood carvings, all with a thousandfold magic of the Moorish style. It doesn't look very much like the Alhambra from the outside, but there are many details of it which are taken from the Alhambra, and the interior was much more Alhambresque in style. Kaiser Friedrich Wilhelm IV had in 1842 built a pump house at Sanssouci Park in Potsdam that some of you might be familiar with. It looks like a Mamluk mosque from the exterior, but inside it's pure Alhambra. This was the romantic Alhambra, as seen and collected by designers like Owen Jones and Carl von Diebitsch, all bright colours reinstated and columns and gold columns imagined. In 1867, Prussia sent this Alambresque-style kiosk to represent itself at the Universal Exhibition in Paris, much to the disapproval of the Spanish delegation, who wrote that they really were the ones who should have sent an authentic Alhambra copy to the exhibition. This was the height of fashion among the wealthy society of Western Europe and North America since the mid-19th century, to create this exotic space within one's own home. Gewinner's Berlin colleague, Emil von Staus, had an oriental room modeled on the Aleppo room in the Berlin Museum in his house, while in nearby Potsdam, the banker Herbert Gutmann had a Damascus room built in his house. A mix of authentic oriental objects and copies made for the European market were used to furnish them. Jones's contemporary, the architect Karl von Diebitsch, made this kind of furniture to order. He didn't only make furniture, oriental style furniture, he also made cast iron columns, Alhambra style columns, so you could make your own Alhambra room at home using his new materials of cast iron. So for Gewinner then, the idea of building an Alhambra, a kind of Alhambra in his home in Berlin was not completely new. He was a lover of Goethe and no doubt influenced by the West Eastern divan. He saw the Alhambra as part of a shared cultural heritage to which he in Berlin could lay claim. For Gewinner to buy the palace, to take out the cupola and bring it home was a natural extension of his feeling at home in the Alhambra. Sometime between the summer of 1888 and when ownership of the building passed to the Spanish state in 1891, Gewinner asked the tenant, the opera singer, to take the ceiling down from the tower where it had crowned the Mirador for over half a millennium, had it brought down the hill through the streets of Granada and sent to his house in Berlin. And here you can see the only image we have of the cupola when it was in situ, when it was in place before he took it down, is a sketch of it, a small sketch at the Tate in London, Tate Britain, and it shows just a corner of the cupola and also shows plants starting to grow into the room itself. And then we have this photograph from 1900, which shows shortly after the cupola was taken out, and you can see the frame of it still there. Gewinner used the cupola in Berlin to furnish an Oriental-style room in his home, first at Rauchstrasse and then at his house in Sophienstrasse in Charlottenburg, to where the family moved in 1928. The cupola remained there, reminding Gewinner, he describes in his memoirs, of his youth and his time in Granada for the rest of his life. It was literally a place where he could go to remember, to be nostalgic. The photograph shows that Gewinner didn't simply erect the ceiling in a Berlin interior, but he actively curated a Spanish or Moorish room in which something of the atmosphere of Al-Andalus and the Mirador for which the cupola was created could be imagined. It sits low in the room when he had these ajimes or double window made by a famous carpenter at the time specifically for this. He has the X-frame chairs, the furniture, and the Oriental style lamp and wall tiles and stucco decoration put in place to make this whole room feel somewhat authentic. After his death in 1931, both of Gewinner's houses in Berlin were bombed during the World War II, but not before the cupola was removed by his children for safekeeping and brought to his country house out in Krumke. Remarkably, it survived the war largely intact. There is a story that Russian soldiers who were living in the house later on in the war, that they might have burnt some of the panels. And a small number of the panels, the parts of the cupola, very small number of them had to be remade later on. But who knows how much truth is in that story. In 1978, the cupola came on the market as his grandson sought to sell it. It was first offered back to the Alhambra, but the director of the Patronato then petitioned the Spanish Ministry of Culture for the funds to buy it. This is in 1978, but without success. It was finally bought by the museum when it was in West Berlin Dahlem, where it stood until its move to Museumsinsel in the 1990s. It made one more journey overseas as a key piece in the seminal Al-Andalus, the Art of Islamic Spain exhibition that was held at the Metropolitan Museum in New York in 1992. It returned then to Berlin to be restored by the museum in 1993 before it was installed in the position where you see it today, in 2000. Back in Granada at the Partal Palace, a replica wooden cupola crowns the Mirador room. Recent, very recent collaborations between the Alhambra and the museum in Berlin have led to the digital scanning and detailed mapping of the palace interior and the cupola, with the aim that the two can be somehow reunited in the virtual world, at least, to give visitors here in Berlin and in Granada the chance to experience something of the atmosphere of the cupola in its original environment. So just to conclude, the Alhambra has for generations been the subject of poetic imagination, as artists and writers have been inspired by the exquisite beauty of its palaces. It's no surprise that its creators saw the architecture and its craftsmanship through poetry, inscribing verse into the very fabric of the walls. The cupola hangs today on permanent display, further from its place of production than its creators could probably ever have imagined, but witness, I think, to a curiously European story of extraordinary Nasrid Islamic craftsmanship in a palace in Spain, of a fascination with the Orient in the West, and of the keen eye and collecting habits of a certain Arthur von Gwinner. Thank you.